From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is The ER. This week, what it's like for Iranians living under U.S. sanctions. In July of 2015, the United States signed the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. It's better known as the Iran Nuclear Deal. In broad terms, the deal lifted economic sanctions in exchange for Iran suspending its nuclear ambitions. Some called it a major diplomatic achievement. President Trump saw it as a disaster.
At the point when the United States had maximum leverage, this disastrous deal gave this regime, and it's a regime of great terror, many billions of dollars, some of it in actual cash. A great embarrassment to me as a citizen and to all citizens of the United States.
That's from a speech Trump gave this May, in which he formally pulled the United States out of the deal. In the ensuing months, tensions have continued to escalate.
In a tweet written in all caps and directed explicitly at Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, Trump wrote, quote, "Never ever threaten the United States again, or you will suffer consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered before."
But despite the vitriol, Trump has also said he's willing to negotiate directly with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani without preconditions on a new nuclear deal. His bargaining chip? Harsh economic sanctions, which the administration reinstated in August. Using sanctions to coerce Iran into giving up its nuclear ambitions started back in 2006.
The United Nations has passed a clear resolution requiring that the regime in Tehran meet its international obligations. Iran must abandon its nuclear weapons ambitions.
But while American presidents have all maintained that their anger is with the Iranian leaders and not the people, the fact is the pain of sanctions falls most heavily on ordinary Iranians. Jason Rezaian is an American journalist with The Washington Post. He covered Iran for years and lived there during the sanctions era. He spent more than 18 months in an Iranian prison on false charges of espionage. He was released in 2016. Jason's here with me now. Welcome.
Hey, Sarah. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So we're here to talk about Iran.
Oof.
And unsurprising.
Yeah.
And sanctions. But because the U.S. has just imposed sanctions yet again, and you've written about sanctions numerous times, both the original sanctions and the current ones.
Yeah, I thought I was done with that, but, you know, here we are again.
But before we do that, I wanted to actually go back to your first moments in Iran as an adult,
yeah.
2007. How did you end up going?
So I've been traveling back and forth. My dad was from Iran. My mom's American. I started going there in 2001, and I knew that journalism was what I wanted to do, whether it was going to be in Iran or somewhere else. I'm fortunate to travel a lot as a young man, and when I finally was able to go to Iran, I felt like a kid in a candy store. So many stories,
wow.
You know? And I made that move in 2009, actually. I've been traveling back and forth, and I just kind of decided that this was my, you know, passion and what I wanted to be working on, and I'd been flirting with the idea and going back and forth pretty regularly for 7 or 8 years and moved there.
Did you have family still there? Or?
Yeah. I mean, my dad has three sisters that still live in Iran, but I'm not particularly close with them. They don't live in Tehran. They live in another part of the country. And no, I mean, I kind of built my own life there.
Did you speak Farsi when you got there?
When I moved there in 2009, I picked up quite a bit, but I didn't grow up speaking Farsi, you know, with a mom from Illinois and a dad from Iran, but, you know, having lived in the U.S. since he was 20 and really wanting to live an integrated life. I mean, my real name is Jason. Most Iranians have some more traditional type name, and people are, you know, what's your Iranian name? I'm like, well, name's Jason.
So you get there, it's 2009, when you're settling in.
Yeah.
Did you feel accepted as a journalist? Did people see you as foreign, as somewhat of a native son?
I think people always, in a country as traditional and sort of old school as Iran, I mean, it really has this sense of itself going back thousands of years, that no matter what you do, you're always going to be kind of foreign.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, I think there was an appreciation, and there is an appreciation for any foreign person that comes and wants to get to know the place. I mean, Iran has been so ostracized and so kind of, I don't want to say forgotten about, because it's definitely not forgotten about, but, you know, painted in such stark tones,
mm-hmm.
right? So that when a normal person or normal people recognize that an outsider is there really trying to either visit the place and enjoy its beauty or get to know its people, that's something that's meaningful to them. And at the same time, some people would obviously think to themselves, what the hell is this guy doing here? Like,
mm-hmm.
you know, why? Who would give up their life in San Francisco to come to Iran? And I guess this guy. But you know, that's
What were the stories you wanted to tell? I mean, were you hoping to tell stories of regular people?
Yeah, I mean, look, there was obviously lots of stories about the government and, you know, the nuclear program and the missile program and, you know, their rabid anti-Americanism, which is all very real and true, but you know, it's a vast country,
mm-hmm.
and one with, you know, a lot of characters. And I thought that I could hopefully sketch some of those characters out in stories. It's not like covering a Western capital,
mm-hmm.
right, where you can reasonably expect to interview statesmen fairly regularly. That just doesn't happen, right? And even if you did, they're going to say the same things that they say, you know, in their press statements, or you know, and I guess that's becoming the case here as well. But you know, it was way more interesting to me to sit down and talk with a small business owner or a college student or a drug addict or you know, on down the line.
Tell me a favorite story about a regular person.
I really liked the story I did a few months before I was arrested about a clinic for rehabilitating female drug addicts.
Hmm.
That was, you know, one of the best things that I wrote. I was able to go and spend a day with these women. And, you know, a lot of them had been sort of kicked out of their families. Many of them had been kicked out of their families, although they'd been brought into drug abuse by a male relative. And just sort of the feeling of being ostracized and not having a lot of options was something that really touched me. And I hope I was able to impart to my readers as well. I wrote other stories that I really liked, but it was always coming back to a central character or characters illuminating a larger issue, mm-hmm. within Iranian society. And oftentimes it came back to sanctions,
mm-hmm.
right? In those years especially, because, you know, this is a country that was really heavily isolated economically, but also, you know, in other ways that you don't think of. You know, the passport, and we're seeing this even more now with the travel ban, the Iranian passport's almost worthless,
mm-hmm.
right? So you have this country that supposedly we're saying, we support you and your rights to, you know, free expression and self-determination and freedom. At the same time, you can't come here, right? And so what do people do? How do they manifest their frustrations in a place where they're not able to do that? How do they let off steam in a society where they're not encouraged to do that? How do they, you know, find exits, even mm-hmm. temporary ones, to the circumstances of their everyday lives? And that, to me, was what kept me sort of fascinated and engaged.
You were there for the 2009
I was.
Yeah. Green Movement.
Yeah.
Were you there at the outset?
Yeah. Yeah. And then, like many other foreign journalists, I was told I had to leave. And then I made the decision to go back,
mm-hmm.
in September of 2009. I mean, I was there for the first week or so,
mm-hmm.
and left and came back. And you make calculations,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not particularly good at math. So, you know, I went, and it was, I'm glad that I did. It was tough going for a long time. I didn't have permission to work as a journalist for
What did that mean to not have permission?
So when you don't have permission, if you've had permission and then you don't have permission, there's all this new scrutiny on you, right? Who is this guy?
Is there someone following you?
There can be. You know, there's people listening to your phones and, you know, you get phone calls from Ministry of Islamic Guidance and Culture. That's the name of the press ministry saying, you know, you better not be working. Yeah, I mean, and I was working in the sense that I was observing, but I wasn't publishing anything, right? And I did that for a while. And then finally, they let me work again.
You were there in 2012 when the Obama administration imposes the sanctions.
Yeah.
Walk me through it. What was it like? What did you immediately feel? And how did the squeeze manifest in the street?
Yeah. So I remember reading that, you know, within some weeks, there was going to be a ban on Iranian transactions via the SWIFT banking system.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, we all know what a SWIFT number is if you've ever made a, you know, electronic transfer. The average Iranian has never heard of that. And they think to themselves, well, we do everything in cash here anyway. You know, like, that's not going to hurt us. And I think, honestly, that was the mentality of the government as well, because they were clearly not prepared for this.
Mm-hmm.
But when I saw that, I remember talking to people and saying, no, this is going to be much more intense than you guys can even realize.
Mm-hmm.
And it was. And, you know, the way that it first manifested itself was in a steep decline in the value of Iran's currency versus the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
Iran's currency is not a convertible one, right? Which means that, you know, you can't walk into a money exchange in New York or in Tokyo or in Dubai or whatever and hand them Iranian riyals and expect to get anything in exchange except a snicker, you know, and I don't mean the bar, you know. So it's sort of a tough situation to begin with, and it got increasingly tougher. So when you have a situation where your currency loses, you know, a large portion of its value. In the case of Iran in 2012, it was about 70% of its value in a several week period, right? So it's worth one third of what it was worth before. And most of what you're buying is imported.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that you're buying that are domestically produced require some form of imported either material, ingredient, or technology.
Mm-hmm.
Every transaction that you have is affected by the value of your country's currency. And it's not something that anybody ever thought about before.
Mm-hmm. You
walk into a store and, you know, you reach your hand in your pocket and you pull out the same money that you pulled out yesterday to buy, you know, a pound of meat. And now it doesn't buy you half a dozen eggs.
What were the things that people needed most that they couldn't get? I mean, medicine and food were not supposed to be affected, but they were.
Right. Look, what happens is those things are not stopped, right?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's saying you can't get your cancer medicine or your insulin or whatever. But if Iran doesn't produce it, they're going to have to bring it from the outside, right? If you can't pay your bill, if the money of your country is not worth anything and you can't convert it to a foreign currency to make that transaction, how are you going to get it, right? You figure out ways. You figure out ways through secondary, you know, black markets, over land, over water. You know, there's this long-standing trade between Iran and the UAE via Dubai by wooden boat. I mean, boats that go, you know, they've been doing this for 500 years. So they figure out how to get stuff in. But, you know, a lot of people, I remember reading stories in the local press that they would have to, you know, go into Turkey. And it was like going to buy crack.
Wow.
Right? You go to some place and somebody would have to get a prescription for a drug that they didn't need. They'd get somebody to fraudulently write a prescription and then they'd take wads of cash and, you know, get it and bring it back to their sick relative in Iran. And then repeat.
Mm-hmm.
And then repeat. Imagine what that does to the psyche of a country. And in the meantime, people, you know, not an inconsequential number of people end up dying because they don't get what they need.
Obviously, in theory, this is supposed to squeeze the mullahs.
Right.
In reality, as you've written, it squeezes the people.
Look, sanctions squeeze people first, right? And whether the stated intention is to, back a state and its people into a corner where the people rise up against their oppressive masters. Is the plan stated or not? That seems to be, you know, the hope in most of these sanctions regimes. Right?
But this is not just – when people think about sanctions, maybe they realize you can't get, as you've written, you can't get your Kit Kat, you can't get your Nutella or your lipstick.
Right.
But it's also that people might die from – so it's everything.
It's everything. It's everything. It's a ripple effect that cuts through everything. And the people – and, you know, I took some heat for writing about Kit Kats and Nutella from people. But you know what? There's a middle class in Iran, right? Mm-hmm. And they've gotten used to creature comforts mm-hmm. that, you know, you come to take for granted at a certain point. And when your little kid is complaining about where's my chocolate mommy, right, mm-hmm. you are going to try and fill that void when you can. And the people that are controlling – your access to those things are the exact same people that we're supposedly sanctioning, right? They're the ones that control the borders. They're the mm-hmm. ones that control the flow of any kind of goods coming in and out of the country. So they jack up the prices and make a killing. And if you drove around Tehran in 2012 and 2013, you would have been shocked to see the number of most high-end model of Lamborghini and Porsche and Ferrari in the streets of Tehran, and it was disgusting.
But why?
Because a small number of people are profiteering off of this horrible situation mm-hmm. that is affecting the masses. And there was no shame in kind of displaying that wealth. You know, being an uber wealthy guy was not something to hide. And I think the early years of the Islamic Republic, up until maybe 8-10 years ago, even these people that were well connected to the system, making, you know, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, would try and be subtle about their wealth. And that just stopped, right? It's just like, you know what? I'm a kingpin in my own town. Who cares?
What does that do to the social fabric around you?
Look, I think it makes it a very desperate situation, mm-hmm. A. And B, the kind of moral standards of people diminish, mm-hmm. right? You create a situation where everybody is for themselves. And I think, as I've said, Iranians have a long and cherished tradition, culture, and history that I hope can bounce back from these blows, right? But the values and morals in the society take a hit.
The desperation that you've written about extensively, one thing that jumped out at me from your most recent piece on sanctions was selling kidneys.
Right. Yeah. Iran is one of the few countries in the world where you can legally sell an organ. And that's a weird thing in itself. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I remember writing at that time an article about the different signs of how the economy and how people were affected. And I lived near a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be literally like want ads, yeah. You know, classified. People would paste flyers and printouts on the wall saying, you know, kidney for sale, call this number.
Wow.
Right? You know, type A positive blood or whatever, you know, this is how much it is. And to the extent that even in local domestic television shows, they were making jokes about it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like there was a running theme in one of the most popular shows about one of the main characters' brother's need for a kidney. I mean, it was like a thread through a season of a show.
Oh.
And 'cause everybody could relate.
So here we are, and sanctions have just been reimposed.
Yeah.
Are you in touch with people on the ground?
I am.
And what are they saying?
They're saying that, you know, the price of basic goods that they've come to be able to reasonably afford, you know, has doubled and tripled in a small period of time. Rents are through the roof. I think that there's a real clear fear that this can only get worse. And I remember that attitude several years ago that, okay, we've hit bottom. And I remember thinking to myself, no, you haven't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and Iran still hasn't hit a bottom. It's still very far from that. It could get much, much worse. Now you're having massive water shortages, massive electricity outages, and food is getting more and more expensive.
Trump has said he would meet with Rouhani.
Yeah.
You think that'll happen? And what would happen if he did?
I think that both of them are ready, and it's something else that I've written about some. I think there's a strange sort of fascination between U.S. and Iranian leaders. There always has been.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that these two in particular are more inclined to meet and greets than their predecessors.
Mm-hmm.
But to what end, right? I think that the Trump administration has varying views within itself. My sense is that Secretary of State Pompeo, as much as he's an Iran hawk and would love to see this regime disappear, also sees himself as a diplomat and somebody that can broker negotiations. You know, I saw John Bolton on various cable news shows the other day saying that regime change is not our policy. It may not be our policy, but it's certainly John Bolton's policy. It's been his policy about Iran his entire career. He only talks about his desire to destroy the mullahs, right? And I think President Trump has a very different take than both of them.
Mm-hmm.
That, hey, you know what? My predecessor did a thing with this country. I can do a thing better than he did, and I'm going to do it. So those are three very different points of view on this. I think within Iran, Rouhani has staked his entire political reputation and career on this nuclear deal and bringing his country out from under the weight of sanctions. He's won two elections on that promise, and the results have not kicked in.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's also making a play that he is the natural successor for the current supreme leader once he dies. And I think that there are a lot of people inside of Iran jockeying for that position, but also, you know, people in the military that want to see the clerical government or the civilian government diminished in responsibility and power. So, I mean, do I think that they'll meet? Yeah, I do at some point. But I think we're rhetorically a long way off from that because both of them have painted themselves into rhetorical corners that will be hard to kind of just step forward and say, okay, I can do this today.
You've noted, though, that under sanctions, Iran will crack down further on social media.
Of course they will. Of course they will. We're already seeing that. And, you know, this is one more reason why, you know, a policy that doesn't actively promote the freedom of expression and the ability of opposition forces to flourish
mm-hmm.
is such an important component of
– it's counterintuitive.
Exactly. And, you know, I think that there's folks that are just starting to write about that now, people that have supported these sanctions
mm-hmm.
saying, well, what about – you know, what about your support for the Iranian protesters?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, those of us who've been watching this for years realize that there isn't going to be any support for the Iranian protesters. That's a fact.
Mm-hmm.
You don't put a travel ban in place on these people. I mean, there's no free flow of dialogue between the Tehran streets and Washington right now. We've cut that off, right? So, you know, I think that what's happened is we've created this bubble around Iran, and that's only going to be reinforced by these new measures.
Can the Europeans fill in at all? I mean, the EU has said they don't want to abide by it. Obviously, Trump is sort of saying that he'll cut off relationships or business relationships with anyone who doesn't abide by the sanctions.
Right.
The EU, obviously, Macron, Merkel, the leaders tried to come in and convince Trump not to do this.
Yeah.
Can the EU save any of it for them?
I don't think so because, you know, European companies are already pulling out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, again, that's a function of Iran's dysfunctionality and
mm-hmm.
Iran's inability to ensure potential foreign investors that it's a safe and stable economy where they're going to see growth, right? I don't think that the situation is conducive to the Europeans making a stand. Same time, the Russians and the Chinese will definitely profit from the situation. China came out yesterday and said, we're not going to abide by America telling us we can't buy Iranian oil. Why would they?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? So the difference might be that because there's not a consensus on what's trying to be done with these sanctions, that they might be less effective in terms of stifling Iran's economy than the ones in 2012 and 13 were. That being said, they're still going to have a massive effect. They're still going to make life very difficult for Iranians and they're still going to, honestly, I think slow down actual movements towards a freer, more open Iran that have been taking place for a very long time, driven by people who can't stand their leadership. I want to be on their side.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we've established that sanctions disproportionately harm regular Iranians.
Right.
And not the mullahs.
Right.
But you, better than many, if not most of Americans, know that Iran is a tough actor.
Yes.
What do you do to put pressure on the state?
Well, look, first and foremost, I think you have to open up lines of communication and lines of dialogue between all Iranian actors in the United States. You know, we in the Bush administration, they had a saying that we don't negotiate with evil. Right. Mm-hmm. That seems pretty ridiculous to me. We talk to everybody. That's what the largest power in the world is supposed to do. One. But at the same time, when you're talking to them, you need to be talking to the people as well. And I don't think that we're doing a very good job of sending messages. I don't think we've ever done a good job of sending messages, clear messages, to the Iranian people of how we're going to help them. The only messages we're sending to them are reinforcing the idea that we're hurting them.
Mm-hmm.
We're hurting them because we think it's going to ultimately hurt their own oppressors. That just seems ridiculous to me, right? I mean, we need to do things. We need to promote and encourage flows of information and people. And I agree 100% that, you know, the people that come from Iran or any country should be heavily vetted before they're able to enter the United States. But frankly, the vetting that goes on for an Iranian to visit the United States is among some of the most extreme vetting that's ever existed for entry into the United States. And people still want to come. This is a society in love with America or their vision of America, despite everything that their regime has been telling them for 40 years, death to America, America's the great Satan, America's the root cause of all of our despair. They love nothing more than to interact with this country, interact with our products, our ideas, our universities. We should let that happen.
Jason, I saw that you supported Iran in the World Cup.
Of course. Yeah.
But I will also say that, and we've purposely not talked about this because we'll have you back soon, I hope.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
You were in prison for 544 days. You're writing a book about it. I'm going to have you back just to talk about the book, I hope.
I like that.
What would happen if you went back now?
Look, that's not going to happen. Yeah. So, a lot of people will have to come and go safely before I ever take that kind of risk. I think my big brother and my wife and my mom would, the collective power of the three of them could probably hold me back. Look, I think a lot's going to have to change there. And I know that regime is a really bad actor in a bad neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
One of the worst in the neighborhood. there's some other bad guys around.
But there's a part of you that regrets that you can't return.
Of course. Of course. I mean, I chose to base my life there. I got married there.
Mm-hmm.
My wife is from there. We were building a life there. We were building a life there that we hoped would, be one that we could develop and could, come and go. And that was taken away from us. And now we're here. And, I love my life in America. I love being an American. I consider myself American before anything else. Always have. I think part of that, though, was the ability to take that blue passport of mine, mm-hmm, and tromp around the world and get to know different places almost without limitation. And now I look at a large swath of the map and I don't feel comfortable going there. And that's unfortunate. And I hope that that's not forever.
It's been such a privilege to talk to you. I really can't wait to read your book.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on, Sarah. I appreciate it.
Thanks for coming in. You've been listening to The ER. Our show is produced by Dan Efron and edited by Rob Sachs.